I'm going to talk about some work that I've done that's been with two people. Jesse Sheldon was a grad student at MIT, now she's a postdoc at Rutgers, and she's awesome. And this is Wyatt Taylor, who most of you guys probably know, is a faculty member at MIT. I'm going to be talking about these two papers, and their numbers, if you want them. And yeah, so let's see. This talk is probably going to be about 45 minutes of review material and then 15 minutes of new results, but that's fine. I just kind of want to get the basic ideas across. Sorry, 20. So the outline of the talk is I'm going to start off with a warm-up and tell you about a free course with some NSNS freeform flux on it, and that'll be fun. Then I'll talk about some new stuff where we consider type 2 on T6 mod C2, and then the rest of that you can just read, and I'll get to it when we get to it. So even if I only get through these two sections in the hour, I'll be super happy. All right, so let me start with section 1, warm-up, T3, free torus with NSNS freeform flux. Okay. So let's start off. Here's the deal. I'm going to have coordinates. X, Y, and Z on my free torus. I'm going to make them periodic, it's a torus, with period 1, like that, etc. Okay, same for Y and Z, that's periodic in each direction, period 1. And I also want to put some amount of freeform flux on it, and there are a bunch of prefactors involving 2 pi's and alpha primes I'm leaving off here. But let's just say I put n units of H flux on this torus. Okay, so to get this, I can pick a B field, right? H is just dB. I can pick a B field in the x and y direction that goes linear as z. And sure enough, I take the this thing, it just hits the z, I get n units of H form flux, since the volume of T3 is 1 in the units, I think. OK, great. So one thing I want to say right away to eliminate any possible objections is I'm taking a flat thing here, and I'm putting H flux on it. All right, so this is not a good string background. Right? It's not a solution to the string equations of motion. That's fine for what I'm going to say. That's not going to matter. I'm just using this as an illustrative example of how to get interesting backgrounds, and in particular non-geometric backgrounds, out of known string backgrounds. OK, so this is not a solution to the string equations of motion. But I don't care. What I'm going to say is it doesn't matter. This doesn't matter. Okay, so this is a nice background. There's lots of isometry here. And in particular, I can T-dualize this background to get other interesting backgrounds. All right, so I have a two-form here that is a function of z, but I have isometries in the x and y directions. I have isometries in x and y, so I can do T2i in the x, let me say for the moment, or the y direction. So I'm just going to pick one randomly, and let's say.
How can you physically move these directions in the opposite? I mean, it's just a KHP.
It's just because I picked this particular form for the B field. There's no, I mean, I could have picked anything. Right now, x and y are completely, this is just a symmetric free torus, and I happen to pick a particular gauge. So this is just a function of my choice for that. It's a good question that we'll see some echoes of later. What's special about the choice I've made here? You'd think this is a completely symmetric thing, it shouldn't matter. As we'll see, there'll be a hint of maybe how I can actually get away with it, dualizing the z direction. And in some sense, that'll actually be the central point of everything I say. All right, so let's do T duality in the X direction. Push this up.
Is there something hiding under there?
No. Great. All right, so I'm not going to write down the equations I use to do this. This is a pretty straightforward thing. You use the so-called Boucher rules, which just tell you how, given a background, you get a new background out when you do a T-duality. So it's very they're very straightforward to write down. I'm not going to go through the trouble of writing them down right now. But basically, the idea is that when you do T-duality in some direction here, the metric, you know, T-duality, remember, is just R goes to 1 over R. Basically, you're taking a direction of this torus and flipping the radius. Effectively, if you have a B field in there as well, what that ends up doing is switching metric and B field along with some other changing some other stuff around as well. So I can get a new background out of this first one. And so let me just write down what it is. It's pretty straightforward. Basically, all that's going to happen is that B field, BXY, is just going to move into the metric. So since I picked, you know, everything with radius 1 here, well, you know, there's not much going on in the metric by itself. But what's going to happen is that B field is going to go into the metric. And so I get a background that looks like this, dx plus nz dy squared. Plus dy squared plus dz squared. And then no B field. There was no off-diagonal term in the metric to begin with, so now there's no B field. That term in the B field just shows up here in the metric. So this is a very well-known and extremely well-studied type of space. This is what's called a twisted torus. Okay, so let me give you some intuition for what this thing actually is. You can see that, well, why is it called a twisted torus? You can see that if I've made everything periodic with period 1, that looks like there's some sort of problem as I take z goes to z plus 1 here. Right? In particular, this metric is not globally well-defined as written. But you can patch that up by doing the following thing. I'm going to change my coordinate identifications. So in particular, as z goes to z plus 1, Is Z is Z in Canada or Z?
Z?
Okay. Z? Okay. As Z goes to Z plus 1, what I'm going to do is I'm going to fix this thing up. You'll see this metric is just going to shift by NDY. So if I just do that to X, if I re-identify the coordinate like that, the metric is still globally well-defined. And this is exactly why it's called a twisted torus, because what's going on here is that I've got some circle in the z direction with T2 in the x and y direction spiraled over it. And as I go around that circle in the z direction, I twist this torus around. I twist the x and y coordinates of the torus. Okay, so this is why this thing is called a twisted torus.
Right.
Sorry. Yeah.
Is it really a manifold?
Yes. This is a perfectly well-defined manifold. Yeah. Well, the things I'm going to do next will not be manifolds, as you'll see. But at the moment, this is just some nice, well-defined manifold. It is curved.
So are they non-string background? Like, this is some part of the compact space and
other things? Yeah, like what you can do is you can actually, by putting other fluxes on this, you can make these into perfectly good string backgrounds. Yeah. I mean, I'm not at all doing justice to the study of twisted tori here. These things, I mean, have been extremely well studied. And there are certainly plenty of good string backgrounds which you can build out of. This is not.
Is this also locally flat everywhere?
No, this is not flat. As you'll see, I'm going to actually break down the spin connection in just a second. The spin connection actually is this. All right, so let me rewrite the metric here in an illustrative way. So I'm just going to write down what actually is a pretty general form for twisted torus. And I'm just going to rename this thing n, f super x sub yz. And the reason I'm doing this is because I want to have some name for this. Okay, so this n started off as some h flux. I want to have some name for what this n is in this new background. And I'm going to think of it as this thing I've called fxyz. So when I do t-duality in the x direction, I'll explain why this notation actually makes sense in just a second. When I do t-duality in the x direction, it takes this thing, this hxyz, what we're doing, and basically raises this x index and gives me something that I actually can, and I'll talk about this in a second, think of as an SNS two points.
Well, I didn't quite understand. So the metric that you wrote, it does not solve the string theory equations without additional clusters.
Correct. Just like the original background did neither. I'm taking something that's not a good string background to something else that's not a good string background. Yeah. But again, I'm not claiming this is a good string factorization. I mean, if you look at the things that are necessary for the Boucher rules, nowhere in there is there anything about having being a good string background. Right, just the existence of some isometry takes you from one background to another. Once I want to use this in some string compactification, then of course that's an important question to ask. But at the moment, I'm just using this as a toy example to relate different things.
And what about the beta function equations?
They are not solved. Here. I mean, this is not. This doesn't give you a conformal theory. But I don't care about that. Right. All right. That's going to be a question that, when it's relevant, I won't be able to answer. I mean, it's some flux compactification here. It's not really known, especially in these non-geometric backgrounds, what the beta function equations are going to be. Okay, but it's certainly an important question to ask, is this a good string compactification? I can tell you that this is definitely not, but the eventual object I end up with, that's something that needs to be studied about. All right, so I claim that this thing over here, this F, this is actually, in a very easy sense, some kind of NSNS two form. So what do I mean by that? So let's write down a bunch of globally defined one form. Okay, I'm going to call these eta x, eta y, and eta z. No. And I'm just going to read them off the metric. Right? Each one form in this metric here that I've written, this is sum of three one forms squared. Each of those one forms is globally well defined. So I can just write this like that. But you can see that if I look at D of these guys, D of eta x, this is not closed, right? I hit this and I get a dz dy, so I can write this as n eta y over j to z, or this thing I've called f, and this is why I'm using that notation, f x y z eta y z. So it's in this sense that I claim this thing f is some kind of NSNS two. And it's basically the spin connection. Okay, great. So this is a twisted torus background. This is like the simplest example of a twisted torus you can imagine. It's really just a T2 fibered over an S1. You can do this as much. You can do T6 versions of this, and then you get all different Fs corresponding to which direction they're fibered over and what the torus twisting is happening. I'm not going to do any of those extensions.
So maybe I'm asking back Yevgeny's question. So if we go back up there, so that's not the back. That will be a background of string theory if I put the string coupling to zero, right? So then the Newton constant equal to zero and it's a flat background. But here you said there is a finite curvature. So
yeah, for the twisted torus, I mean, it's that's right. So here,
right. So how do I see? And there is no. Where is the string?
I don't even want to think about this as a string compactor, as a good string compactification. Yeah. I mean, there are certainly things you can do to include such things in a good string compactification, including fibering it over stuff and messing with the dilaton, whatever you want. I'm not claiming anything about this being a string compactor. When I get to section two, I'll have a different state. All right, so was there anything else I wanted to say about that? I think not. OK, great. So now, what do we do? Well, we have this nice background I've written down over here. It's still got a z in it. To get from the original one, I did t duality on the x direction. So I can actually keep going. I can do some more t dualities. I still can't t dualize in the z direction, because there's manifestly not isometry there. But I can t dualize the y direction. I can do x too, but that's boring. It just gets me back to where I started. So let me t dualize the y direction. So, one thing I wanted to say is that if you think about what this background is doing, a nice way to think about this background is that as you go around this this circle in the z direction, you're shifting the complex structure of the torus. All right. So one thing you can think here is that this is actually like as z goes to z plus 1, tau, the complex structure of that torus, goes to, I guess, tau plus or minus, plus.
Tau of what torus?
Tau is of the T2 fiber. Right, the torus in the x and y. OK, so now let's do ty. Again, you can write down the Boochian rules. It's super simple to do this. I'm not going to write down the calculation. I'll just write down the answer. And the answer is this. Ds squared is 1 over 1 plus n squared z squared dx squared dy squared plus dz squared. And here we also get a B field back, which looks like it's in the xy direction. And it looks like that. So you can see basically what's happening here. I mean, the reason I'm getting all these 1 over 1 plus n squared z squares is because dy squared, the metric in the yy direction, is just 1 plus n squared z squared. And if you work everything out, it looks like this. OK, so what the hell is this? You can see that something weird is going on, right? I can't do, here I was able to patch things up when z goes to z plus 1, still make everything globally well-defined by doing this twisting. Here's something weirder is happening as I take z goes to z plus 1. So what is this? Well, there's an easy way of thinking about this back. So you might guess, because we did a t-duality here, there was a nice way of thinking about it in terms of the complex structure of this torus. Usually, when you do a t-duality, right, you switch complex structure and Kähler's. So let me write down the Kähler modulus of this torus in the xy direction. So I'm going to take, as usual for a t2, the Kähler modulus of that torus to be b plus iv. These are really integrated over the torus. But if I write down what that thing is, okay, that's pretty straightforward. Here, I just get a prefactor of 1 over 1 plus n squared z squared, and then, well, it's just nz plus I. Still not really straightforward as z goes to z plus 1. There's nothing obvious and nice happening in this. But check this out. 1 over the Killer modulus of this torus is, well, that's easy to do. You just flip this thing and multiply by the conjugate. You're going to get a factor on the bottom that cancels out this thing on the top. You'll just get nz minus I. So as z goes to z plus 1, 1 over the Kalman modulus just goes to 1 over the Kalman modulus plus. Which is not really totally surprising. I mean, if you think about it, we start out with the background where rho goes to rho plus n. Then we have one where tau goes to tau plus n. Another 2 duality gets us to 1 over rho goes to 1 over rho plus n. And this is something that I would call non-geometric. And the reason I call this a non-geometric background is because there's no global, there's no globally well-defined metric here, right? As you go around this z circle, what's happening is that the metric and the b field, like these two parts of rho, are mixing into one another. So this is what I would call a locally geometric, but a globally non-geometric background, because there's mixing. That's a G. Mix. Okay. So that's the second step here. Now you might say, all right, well, up here we have this thing F. Can I extend this? And in fact, well, notationally, it's just write it down. If I do t in the y direction here, let's just say I raise another index. I'm actually not going to get into the details of this right now. But this background is going to be characterized by something I call Q, which has 2 upper index and 1 lower index. And for reasons I'm not going to get into, you can't actually argue that this thing behaves like an NS and S1 form. But that's something I don't want to talk about right now. Okay, cool. So now you might say, okay, well, look, there's an obvious next thing to do here, which is, if I could, do t-duality in the z direction. But I manifestly can't, right? The z is all over the place here. I don't have an isometry in the coordinates in this gauge I've picked in the z direction, so this is completely denied. What I'll argue for actually later, and one of the main points of this talk, is that there is an object that necessarily has to appear here.
Well, so what is the interpretation of this background that you got? It's not a manifold anymore, right?
It is no longer a manifold.
Okay, so what is this?
I don't know what the name for this space is. I mean, this is something that is not, it's not a geometrical space. Right? It's possible that it has, very little is known about this class of backgrounds. All right. One thing is possible is that you can think of it as one of these. I hesitate to use this because I don't really know what I'm talking about here, but it's one of these like generalized complex backgrounds, you know, that Hitchin has been talking about recently, where there's some kind of monodromy that mixes the metric and the b-field. That is totally imprecise. So I don't know I don't know if these things have really been studied or if there's even a name for this. It is not a manifold. It's not a geometrical space.
So in a real model, there's some example where you have some, like, there's a world sheet description of this?
No, so far there are no known world sheet descriptions of this. This is a major outstanding question for these types of backgrounds. What I mean, is there a good thing? Is there a good world sheet description?
But it seems like your starting point has a good world sheet description.
Well, if it were a good, certainly there's not, you know, a world sheet thing you could write down. It's not a conformal theory of world sheet. There's certainly an obvious place to start there. But it's not at all clear to me how to get to this.
So the problem is that if you write down some two-dimensional field theory, you're saying that this two-dimensional field theory with this flux it's going to be have a beta function.
Yes.
Then to inequality
Yeah, I mean, G-duality, you get some other target space here and then some other target space here, but I don't know what. I'm not sure how to write down. It's possible there's a very straightforward answer. I don't know how to write down these kinds of objects.
So this G-duality TY, the G-duality rule is probably correct only locally. That's what you're implying.
Yeah, I mean.
But there is some global description where you get some well-defined answer.
Yeah. We can certainly come back to that later. This is as I'll say many times, this class of backgrounds is really poorly studied. So I can't even say with confidence that these things definitely exist. As good string classifications. I'm going to argue that they do.
Well, if the T-duality is well-defined iteration,
then they should exist, exactly. But there, I mean, most of what we know about these things, we can only argue about through T-duality. It would be nice, and this is, I think, if there's a next thing to work on with these sorts of backgrounds, that's it, to construct a string classification, just directly.
But you have to be careful. I mean, you can only use T-duality in the pusher way.
Right. Yes.
If the curvature terms are small.
Yeah.
You can only do T-duality exactly if you have a worse case.
Right.
I think it's maybe. So the pusher rules is the statement that if you start with solution to the equation of motion, if you own shell, you will go back on shell. It also solves the equation of motion. Now, since what you started with, so the paradox that. Many people were mentioning is probably that we're using Boucher rules, and so it would be nice if you have some explicit solution.
Yeah, definitely. Which I don't. Okay, so now let me. This was really just as I was saying, just a toy example to motivate, just kind of give you a heuristic idea of what we're going to do next, which is try to incorporate these structures here. Into a possibly good real string compactor. Notice, by the way, that in each of these H, F, Q, there's nothing here in this last thing. These are all just the integer n in this example. And so we have n units in this, and this F is an n, this Q. If I were to write this Q here, that Q would be there. Okay, great. So now let me move on to the second step, which is to actually do a T6. So you might say, I can even say a couple words of motivation before I do this. One motivation for even thinking about this type of thing is just the following diagram. Think about type 2 on a very well-known Orient fold, just a T6 mod T2. If you look at the space of all... Yes?
What happens with the super simply as you turn on the flux?
As you turn on what the room?
As n is non-zero.
Is that all defined? Is that all defined question?
Yeah, I mean, this isn't even a good string. In this case, I don't think it's a question. I mean, we need to construct it with a string back time, and then. All right. So what I was about to say is, if you consider type 2 string theory on a T6 mod T2 Orient fold, this sort of theory has been studied extensively in2B and 2A. In 2B, it's known that you can get some Minkowski factor, and you can get some ADS factor, and in 2A, for this thing. It's only really known that, or at least was for a long time, that you can get ADS vacuum on it in 6 months. So the question, if you want the central motivation here, and I'm actually going to make very specific all these things in just a second, is where are the 2A Minkowski vacuum? And the answer to this, I'll claim, is that you actually need to incorporate these non-geometric vacuums in order to get Minkowski vacuum in 2A on a T6 model. Right, and by the most primitive form of mirror symmetry, just doing 3T dualities, you'd think that if you can get Minkowski vacuum, you should be able to realize it 2A as well. Okay.
You get ABS when it's not good enough, no?
No, there are plenty of T6 orientables where you can get ADS. This is, for example, in this paper of Oliver the Wool and Alexander Giravet, Dominic Katcher and White.
After modular stabilization, you get ADS,
or? Yeah, that's what I mean. I mean, in the this ADS is, you look at the vacuum energy in, right, in the 4D theory, moduli or stabilize, you plug them in.
Well, no, I mean, the actions are never stabilized. I mean, the non-periodic fields are stabilized, not the periodic ones.
Look, we can. I'm going to claim that I can stabilize all of these.
Even the axioms?
Yes. Not just the geometric ones. But yeah, this is after you. This is for. I should also say these are supersymmetric vacuums. Once you solve for the moduli of those, then you plug them, you get these. Okay. So let me just quickly review what's known about 2B and 2A. Back. All right, so 2B is super well studied. Lots of papers on this. And we know, I should say that specifically before I get into this. Let me do something even simpler than a T6 mod Z2. Instead of a T6 mod Z2, I'm going to do the following. I'm going to use the following space, which is just a, I'm going to take this T6 mod Z2 orientable and make it such that it's actually three identical T2s. Right, so if you like, I'm doing some other kind of orbifold fold here to get all those T2s to be identical. It's certainly a toy example. Even so, we'll see some interesting stuff. Now let me just assign some coordinates to these T2s. Every coordinate, every T2 is going to have two directions. I'll give each one a Latin and a Greek direction so that the coordinate on, let's say, the first T2 is this coordinate, this complex coordinate, z alpha plus complex structure times z y. All right, so I've just written down a complex coordinate on that T2 in the usual way. And there are three moduli that I'll call S, tau, and U. All right, normally there would be a lot more, but because I've taken this especially simple background where all these T2s are the same, there's only one complex structure modulus, and there's only one Kähler modulus. So in 2B, for example, S is just the usual axis of dilaton. Tau is a complex structure modulus, and U is the Kähler modulus, and in 2A, those guys switch. I'm not going to write down the explicit forms of what these are. All right, so this is the particular compactification that I want to do. And let's just review what's known about 2B. Well, we know that there's a superpotential in the resulting 4D supergravity, which is just the Bukov-Vapa-Witten superpotential,
right,
which is just integral of F3 minus the axis of dilaton times H3 wedge omega. Right? This is just the usual Bukov-Vapa-Witten superpotential in the resulting 4D theory. And if I actually evaluate what this thing is, right? It's pretty easy to write this down. You can see that omega here. Well, on the T6, and even on this T6 right here, omega is basically just DZ1 wedge DZ. It is just DZ1 wedge DZ2 wedge DZ3. So what I'm going to get when I evaluate this is something that looks like this. It'll be some cubic polynomial in the complex structure modulus, right? This just gives me some cubic in the complex structure, whose coefficients are given by the different RR fluxes, wrapping on different cycles of the T6. This polynomial here is also cubic. And its coefficients are given by H flux wrapping different cycles of the T6. So this is a geometric 2B compactification. Specialized here to, this is a very general result. This is specialized to this particular T6 that I'm considering up there. I should also write down that there's a well-known Taylor potential here. So I'm taking the geometrical parts of B and the imaginary parts of these moduli. And then there's also a vacuum energy, which is just given by this. And I'll use this later. OK, so that's 2B. The 2A. In 2A, well, 2A compactifications on this thing on T6s have been studied as well. And what you get if you look at the superpotential in 2A is you get the following. Okay, so you get actually the sum of three terms. This is, again, a cubic polynomial. Tau is now the Taylor modulus in 2A. The coefficients here are given by different RR fluxes. Only P2 and P3 are actually linear polynomials in this case. So this is linear in the Taylor modulus multiplied by the 2A version of the axis of dilaton. And P3 is also linear in the Taylor modulus multiplied by the complex structure. Okay? And in particular, 2A on twisted torus backgrounds has been studied and gives you a superpotential that looks exactly like this. All right, so the point of all this is that there's an obvious mismatch between these 2A and 2B results. Right? One has two cubic polynomials here. One has a cubic and a linear plus a third term that doesn't show up in 2B at all. So the question I want to ask is, how do you resolve this discrepancy? If you think that mirror symmetry in this case is just three T-dualities, literally three T-dualities, shouldn't you be able to just get one directly from the other? And shouldn't there be any vacuum that you can realize in 2B? You should be able to also get in 2B. And so this is exactly where you realize you need to incorporate non-geometric degrees. All right, so this is what this board over here is doing. I've just written down the coefficients of these two polynomials right there. All right, so if you look at what I call P1, right, as claimed in 2B, the different coefficients here, really these are integrated versions of these fluxes, but let's just not worry about that for the moment. In 2B, the coefficients are just our three-form flux wrapped on different cycles. In 2A, let's say I get to 2A by doing T-duality on the alpha, beta, and gamma directions, that is, on one direction of each of those T2s, the coefficients of P1 are just 6-form, 4-form, 2-form, and 0-form. Okay, so that's not amazingly interesting.
So these have fluxes on them to stabilize, and fluxes, so can you still do T-dual models?
Yeah, I think it's. Okay, now P2, you'll see that there are some gaps here, right? In 2B, this is a cubic polynomial, S tau squared, and S tau cubed. The coefficients of the polynomial are just the NS and S three-form integrated updating cycles. But in 2A, the constant term is also an NS and S three-form, but the linear term shows up in these twisted torus backgrounds. That is, in fact, just this twisting that I wrote down before in the twisted torus. And you can see in 2B, there's this, there's absolutely nothing here, where 2A has, this is all what I call P3, 2A has a constant and a linear. Okay, so let's do the following thing. Let's start with the 2A bet. Let's just say we're doing some twisted torus compactification in 2A. This is a perfectly well-defined compactification. There's nothing weird going on. It's not non-geometric. It's a manifold. It's a twisted torus. There's some RR fluxes on it, no problem. All right, so then let's say what do we need to do in order to get to 2B? Well, we just do 3 theta well, and I picked alpha, beta, and gamma to do that. So you can see that everything works on this table exactly as it should. Here, I have to utilize these directions. It just takes the 6-form, 3-form, et cetera. There's no Greek directions there, so that stays the same. And this twisting, Fij gamma, goes to an NSS 3-form flux, just like it did in this example over here. But you can see there's a hole that needs to be filled in 2B. In particular, I get H alpha beta k. It has 2 Greek and 1 Latin index. This should go, according to my little chart there, to something that in 2B has an interpretation as one of these Q fluxes. I need to T-dualize that twice. Now, it's a little bit maybe hard to read, but all of these have either 1 or 3 Greek indices. So these are all going to become Qs as well. J alpha K, IBK, and beta gamma alpha. So I've started with a perfectly good 2A compactification, and I've gone over to 2B. And I found that I need to introduce some of these non-geometric fluxes. In 2B, though, 2B has orientifold 6 planes. So there's a symmetry in the T6. In particular, I can switch what I'm calling the Latin and Greek directions. Right? There's nothing to stop me from doing that. So if I switch Latin and Greek here, basically you can see what that does is that switches different powers of tau. Taking Latin to Greek switches 1 and tau cubed, and it switches tau and tau squared. Right, this has 3 Latin goes to 3 Greek, 2 Latin goes to 2 Greek. So I can do this rotation, if you want, on the T6. No problem with that. But what you see is that in 2B, now these things, these holes are going to get filled in because the constant power of P3 goes into the cube. So let's see, all I do is I change Latin for Greek. This looks like something I call Qij gamma. And all these Qs also go to different Qs. I'll just write down one of them. It doesn't really matter. C beta, gamma, dot, dot, dot. OK, so all I've done so far is I started with a good 2A compactification. I T-dualized to get to 2B, and then I used a rotational symmetry with that torus. Well, I should be able to go back to 2A now. And I'm going to fill in these other holes here. So let's see, going back to 2A, this H has 2 Greeks. That's going to become a Q. This one has 1. This is, it has 2. It's going to flip those guys. That will become a Q. But the most interesting thing that happens here is I find that I need to do another T duality on this Q. I need to get something I'm going to call R, which has 3 upper indices. And so it looks like this thing that we thought couldn't exist from this simple example, this T3 example, it seems that just doing T-duality, starting with a perfectly good geometrical background, doing T-duality, and then using a rotational symmetry, and then doing T-duality again takes us to some other object here, which it looks like, just from this example, can't exist. Okay, and that object I'm going to call R.
Here, the definition of T-duality is following the Bush rule. So, yeah. And as Gary says, it's something else.
Well, there, I mean, so what I'm really saying is that if I want this, if I want these two theories to agree, I need to have this other thing which shows up in the superpotential, which, I mean, it's not even clear how to define what T-duality means, going from this this 2B backup that I got after the rotation to this other thing. But in order to get the superpotentials to match up, I need something to exist here. And the interpretation of what that thing is not at all clear. And in fact, what I'll maybe argue for you later is that in this little chain of stuff here, this is nice and geometric. This is nice and geometric. This is something which is locally geometric, but there's some global problem to matching it up. It seems like this if you want flux R, which if you believe this chain is some kind of NS and S0 form, indicates the absence of even a local geometry.
So you finally get the polynomials to match?
Yes, so I'm getting it. I'll say it in just one second. So the point is, when you do this, like I'll say it right now, when you do this, now you have a general type 2 invariant superpotential. You get W is P1 tau plus S P2 plus U P3. And these are all Q.
I have probably a stupid question. So when you turn on any fluxes, it deforms the metric on this on the 26 to be something else.
Yeah, no, this is certainly something. That
so how do you know that you can use any T-duality?
No, that's a very good question. And I mean, you know, you need to study that back reaction to really believe this.
You're saying you know that it's true?
No, no, no. I don't. I absolutely do not know that's true. That's something. That's an important caveat.
The
U-term is not there, because remember, this is the classic no-scale structure in 2B, right, where there's no dependence on the Kähler modulus. So the U-term is just simply not there. There's no...
Did you say there is some non-geometric flux that causes dependence?
Correct. The claim is that if you put non-geometric fluxes into this 2B compactification, you would restore the dependence on this. You would not restore, you would add a dependence on the Kähler modulus. Exactly. And that's, in fact, I mean, the claim is that's what's necessary in order to get this thing to agree under T-duality, is that if I have such a thing in 2A, I better have it in 2B somewhere. In the simple example, those things all show up as these locally non-geometric fluxes.
So that there is no framing which everything is can be turned into geometric. You always have some cookie.
If you turn on everything in both of these columns, then no. But this is actually a great question, because something you could say is you could say, look, no, stop. You started with a 2A geometrical backup, which only had some subset of these fluxes on. Okay, then I filled in everything in the table. It's not totally obvious you can just superimpose everything I ended up with and get a perfectly good backup. Right? You need to answer that. That's not at all obvious or even possibly true. So you need to answer that question. I don't know. If you can do that.
Are you going to claim now that you can standardize that to be modulized, including Kähler modulus,
yes,
without non-geometric?
Yes, that is exactly right.
But with this near non-geometric box?
Yeah. That's what I was saying. There's nothing non... I mean, okay. I was going to say there's nothing non-perturbative going on here. Obviously, that's why. There's a lot of non-perturbative stuff probably going on here. I just have no idea what any of it is.
Right. It's probably, you know, in this effective description, what we before called non-perturbative corrections would show up as your effective dependence on the
possible.
So the shift symmetry of the action of the Kähler modulus is broken by the flux.
Yeah. All right, so I got 10 more minutes. What do I want to say? Okay. So here's, I think, a nice little thing you could do. So let me just answer this motivational question of where are the 2A Minkowski vector? So one thing you can say, of course, I'm talking about supersymmetric Minkowski vector. Well, the equations of motion, the epsilon equations here, are just the usual thing. This scalar covariant derivative is equal to zero. And one of them, I'll just write them all down. You get three of them because there are three modifiers. P1 plus SP2, sorry, S bar P2 plus U3 equals zero. And then there's another one. And then there's a third. So you get three equations of motion. It's straightforward from that Kaler potential and the superpotential just to the again. But notice what this thing is. So this first equation here, this is really just W plus S bar minus SP2 equals zero. Right? W is exactly that, the superpotential. If I solve in the F terms, I get something that looks exactly like this. You can see where this is coming from, because the derivative of the Kaler potential just gives you one of those 1 over S bar minus S. And there's another. OK, great. So let's see. If I'm looking for Minkowski vacuum, that means I want W equals 0, right? But what does this mean, then? So this says the imaginary part of S times P2 equals 0. Okay. Well, this is a geometrical thing. This is 1 over the string coupling. That can't be equal to 0. P2, in 2A, if P2 is a geometric thing, that's just the constant and linear piece in P2. So let's say I'm looking for a geometric Minkowski vacuum. This means I'm solving something like that. Whoops. And to solve that, I need tau to be real, which is bad, because the geometrical part of this is now zero. It's like the volume, it's a zero volume thing. So if I want a geometric Minkowski vacuum in 2A, no matter how I try to find it, I get some contradiction. So the only way, the claim then is that the only way to get these 2A Minkowski vacuum, supersymmetric Minkowski vacuum, is to include non-geometric fluxes. All right, so I don't have that much time. One thing that's very important here to add, if you start, now that you've written down this superpotential, right, you have all the data you need to study an N equals 1 effect theory coming from these things, right? You have a superpotential, okay, you have only a tree level Kaler potential, but as usual, let's just use that and hope for the best. Well, there are obviously corrections to it, but nothing or very little is known about them. So you have a Kaler potential, you have a superpotential. You can just start throwing in bunches of coefficients here and solving for what types of vacuum you can get or what types of solutions you can get out of these theories. One thing that I'm not going to have a chance to talk about right now is the constraints that are put on these things. Right? Just like in normal two-beacon applications, there's a tadpole constraint. In these non-geometric compactifications, there are T-dual versions of that. There are also Bianchi identities you have to satisfy. I'm not going to talk about that, although I'll be happy to talk about that later. One of the more interesting things, though, is I want to just talk about the different solutions you get. Okay. So one thing we did was we did a bunch of numerical work. And basically the question is, if I just throw up a bunch of random fluxes, these are all integer fluxes, satisfying these constraints, what kind of vacuum can I gather? How many of them will be physical? What are the values of the different moduli? In particular, like what's the value of the string coupling? What's the value of the cosmological constant in 4D? And you actually see some interesting stuff. So let me just very briefly tell you what you find if you do that.
example, the Newton constant. In my definition, there are the Newton constant. I have to know what is the volume of the convectification manifold. And in this case, I don't have a geometric
theory. Yeah. So for the moment, in answering this question, I only want to think about this as an effective theory. I don't care where it came from. Right? I just want to ask, if I think about all these...
But that's sort of a major motivation behind all this. You actually got this by applying neurosymmetry, which is...
Absolutely. So, I mean, you need to, you know, you need to answer, like you said, what, you know, is there a large volume sort of version of all this? As you said, I don't know what volume means in this case. Mm-hmm. Okay? So let me, for the moment, answer what you may argue is a totally unrelated question, which is just, if I start with this superpotential for an n equals 1 theory and that Taylor potential, what are the different solutions? And then you can argue later, you know, which of these, if any, actually came from a string theory. Okay, so let's study n equals 1 supergravity with that superpotential and... So rather than go through all the details of this, let me just summarize some of the results. So if you just write down a bunch of fluxes, this falls firmly into the realm of doing statistics of vacua, or, yeah, n equals 1 vacua. Roughly 20% of fluxes give physical vacua. And by that, I mean vacua in which the moduli have physical values, like there aren't negative volumes, you know, the string coupling isn't negative, things like that. Okay. Something which is weird is if you look at distribution, these vacua in string coupling, which, whether you want to call it the string coupling or not, I really just mean the imaginary part of this modulus S and the cosmological constant space. And so we ran a lot of data here up to fluxes of pretty high values. And it looks like, this is a very surprising result, I guess, it looks like there are an infinite number of vacua in any finite region of geological distance. That is, if you look at how these distributions keep piling up on top of each other, what happens is you have some central thing, you have some vacua like that. And then as you increase the values of these coefficients and look at more, you get more piled up on top of that, but it gets wider and extends a little bit. If you keep extending that, it looks like if you take these fluxes up to infinity, which is very probably not a valid thing to do, you'll get an infinite number of vacua in any finite region of G lambda space. Of course, some of these are, like, I mean, to call them untrustworthy is an understatement. I mean, you have string couplings which are like 10 to the 9. On some of these, right? It's obviously there's something extremely wrong with these vacua. But just thinking about this as an effective theory, if you just look at the solutions, the F-term solutions here, you saw the F-terms, you get this distribution. How many of these actually come from actual string factorizations is not at all obvious. Okay. One thing you can find, though, is you can find there, you know, for example, there are these 2A ADS vacua of Wadding-Taylor and DeWolf, Schaffner, and Gurevets, where they can dial something and control the string coupling and the cosmological constant. They can make them be arbitrarily small. That's something that we can find here as well. You can find controllable, if you like, in some sense, solutions where the string coupling and the in the cosmological clouds, it can be dialed down to be as small as you'd like. So not all of these vacua are in some obviously crazy range. You can get them to be, you know, have very small string coupling and very small cosmological constant as well. Let me again say that this is really just a study of n equals 1 vacua. It is not at all clear how many of those come are realistic string vacua, if any. Right, but that's a question that, I mean, that's a very interesting question. In particular, because of these infinite number of in vacua, this seems to violate certain recent predictions of, you know, finiteness of flux vacua, of a finite number of flux vacua. And it's not clear exactly where this is breaking down. All right, so because of time, I got to stop there. Thanks a lot.